Next, we have Dr. Rich Scarfone. Dr. Scarfone is an associate professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and works as an attending physician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he is the medical director of disaster preparedness, as well as fellowship director. So please welcome Dr. Scarfone for his talk on lower airway emergencies.
Thank you, and I get to be the final speaker of the morning, so hopefully you can hang in there. I am going to speak about lower airway emergencies. No disclosures. This is obviously a fairly broad topic, and what I thought I'd do is focus on those diseases that we see most commonly and really drill down in asthma, bronchiolitis, and pneumonia, talking about not only our management, but really why we do what we do, and hopefully give you an evidence-based approach and highlighting what's more current in the literature. So we'll start with a discussion about asthma, and this will be somewhat case-based. You're seeing a 4-year-old in the emergency department who has a mild asthma exacerbation, and you plan to treat this child with short-acting beta agonist by nebulizer. Right? What could be more straightforward than this? We do this every day in our practices. But you happen to be working with a medical student this particular day, and the medical student says, you know, yesterday I saw a child like this with another attending, and they used an MDI spacer to give albuterol. Why are you using a neb? And then the nurse wants to know how much albuterol to give. And then the mother comes along and says, you know, my nephew is on this newer medicine called Xopenex. Why aren't you using that? And so now all of a sudden your simple case is giving you decision fatigue, and you have to make these decisions. So we'll use this case to talk about each one of those issues. This busy slide is just a reminder that the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, the NIH, has published guidelines. The most recent version was in 07. And this helps us to assess the severity of illness of patients with asthma. So right now we're on the left part of this table talking about the child who's mild. And there are some factors and criteria that we use that are listed here to determine that someone is mild. But getting back to this patient, are NEBs best, is the question that this patient poses. And if we look really carefully at this slide, we could see why NEBs are best, right? It's very obvious. This child is getting intraocular administration of the drug. And we know how effective that is. And here's another child who's getting intracerebral administration of the drug while eating French fries. And that, of course, enhances the absorption of the medication. So, you know, we probably shouldn't be surprised when we set up our patients with NEBs and we walk away and we come back a half hour or an hour later and they're really not much better. And this is a very inefficient way to deliver medication, especially the young child. Think of the infant who spends a very long time in the expiratory phase but has a really short inspiratory time. So any drug that's nebulized during exhalation is really lost to the environment. A lot of the drug adheres to the inner walls of the neb equipment, and it's just very inefficient. In fact, most studies show that less than 10% of the drug that we put in the reservoir actually gets delivered to the alveoli. So getting back to the question, neb versus MDI spacer, there are inherent advantages to each. Right, with NEBs, you can deliver concurrently humidified oxygen if your patient needs it, which is a nice advantage. And it's a more passive way of receiving the medication. The child sits there and receives it and doesn't really require precise coordination between respiratory phases. And definitely, as we talk about, the dosing is better established. 0.15 milligrams per kilo is a well-established dose for albuterol by nebulization, and we'll get back to that point. On the other hand, MDI spacer has some advantages, particularly for the active child, someone who's in school. It's portable. The school nurse can administer it for them. And in the hospital setting, it probably saves some time, right? So whatever staff is responsible for delivering the medication, it takes a lot less time to deliver MDI spacer than a nebulized treatment, whether that's respiratory therapy or nursing time. There may be young investigators in the audience thinking about what can I study in my career. Well, don't study this issue. This has been studied to death. It's very well established. This is a Cochrane review looking at 25 different studies, over 2,000 outpatients, and finding really fairly comparable efficacy. If you look at this literature, this body of literature carefully, in just about every setting that's been looked at, mild to moderately ill patients, patients in office settings, patient in the emergency department, most patients have similar outcomes, whether an MDI spacer is used or a nebulizer. So it really becomes more of an issue of logistics, how best can you set it up in your particular practice, and also cost. And then recently there was a cost comparison analysis performed that was published in 2011, and finding that, if anything, MDI spacer was associated with reduced overall cost. That was primarily getting back to the respiratory therapy and nursing time issue, and that led to reduced cost. So here's my daughter. She's now 17. She got her license 2 days ago. I'm sick about it. But this is when she was not 17 and a lot cuter. And she had mild asthma, and you can see even a child this age, at age two, can adequately receive albuterol with MDI spacer with this adaptation of the face mask. But the dosing is not very well established at all in this setting. And so one of the things that we can do is find out, what are others doing? How do we figure out what dosing to use? What guidelines are out there? Well, it's kind of all over the map. The NIH guidelines say you can give anywhere from 4 to 8 puffs per treatment for children. By the way, that's the same dosing recommendation for adults. The British Thoracic Society says start lower, start with 2 to 4, and titrate up. And you can give as many as 10 puffs per one treatment. And then there's some guidelines in asthma, published asthma guidelines out of Australia and Kansas City, and you can see their dosing recommendation. So I can tell you what we do if we have the mildly ill patient who comes into the emergency department. We recognize that they're probably only going to need 1 or 2 treatments at most, so we can give the treatments intermittently. We've concluded that NEB or MDI spacer are somewhat interchangeable. So in the ED setting, if we're seeing a very young child, less than 10 kilos, you can see the dosing recommendation for NEB, 2.5 milligrams, and we give 4 puffs MDI spacer if we choose to go that route. And then we have 3, this is stratified by weight in at 3 levels, as you can see. And those of you who can quickly, who can perform math more quickly than I can, will note that that dose for the nebulizer therapy is actually higher than 0.15 for the youngest patients, by quite a lot in some cases. But that's okay, because the youngest patients are the least efficient users of the medication. They're the ones that have that very short inspiratory time. Lots of drug is lost to the environment. So comparatively, they're getting a smaller proportion of the drug delivered compared to the older patient. What about Zopenex? Just by show of hands, how many are using Zopenex in their practice fairly routinely? Okay, a few, not too many. Invariably, when I'm working with students or residents and we talk about Zopenex, their response is, oh, that's the form that has fewer side effects. That's their response. And I'll spend the next couple of slides showing you that that's simply not the case. At equipotent doses, the side effects are the same. So this is a figure that shows albuterol, racemic albuterol, which is the albuterol that most of us are using. And you can see it's 2 mirror images of one another. And on the left is the R-albuterol, and on the right is S. And the R-albuterol is where all the activity of the drug resides, as well as all of the side effects. And so Zopenex, or levoalbuterol, is simply pure R-albuterol. It has no S component. So this is racemic, and Zopenex is pure R without S. So what inherent advantage, if any, might Zopenex have? Well, let's try to answer that question. Again, all of the drug activity as well as all of the adverse effects reside in R. And so theoretically, if we're treating our patient, let's say the young child, with 2.5 milligrams of racemic albuterol, that really should be equipotent with half the amount of Zopenex with the same side effect profile. The only way you get fewer side effects is by using that 0.63 milligram dose. But you could achieve the same thing by cutting your racemic albuterol dose in half. Okay? Another way to conceptualize this is by thinking in terms of coffee. So when we're taking racemic albuterol at 2.5 milligrams, that's like drinking a full cup of caffeinated as well as a cup of decaf, whereas Xopenex or levalbuterol is just the caffeinated coffee. And again, the question is, what inherent advantage does levalbuterol have, if any? Well, the only advantage that it might have is if the S component, the decaf component, is in fact harmful. And there are some animal models to suggest this. So S-albuterol in animal models has been shown to release histamine and also to be a weak bronchoconstrictor. So that can't be good. The other thing is that it's metabolized more slowly than R-albuterol. It sticks around longer. So theoretically, our patients who are beta agonist unresponsive, perhaps a subset of them, is because they're accumulating S and are refractory on that basis. But unfortunately, clinical trials haven't supported this. And I'm happy to see that most of the audience is not using Xopenex because it is quite a bit more expensive than racemic and probably not worth the cost. And we'll talk. This is one of the very first studies looking at a comparison of racemic versus levalbuterol. You can see this was a well-performed study in a large number of children. They were children with asthma of any severity, so mild, moderate, or severe. And notice the admit rates. The admit rates were higher in those receiving racemic albuterol, 45 to 36%. The number needed to treat was about 10.5 in this publication. And so this created a little bit of buzz, a little bit of excitement when it was first published. One of the things that if we were to critique this study, we would say, well, why such a high baseline admit rate for the racemic group? Almost one out of every two were hospitalized, even though there were patients who were mild, moderate, or severely ill. So that wasn't entirely clear. But unfortunately, subsequent publications have failed to find a benefit. These were three studies that happened to all be published in 05, and you can see the study numbers. You can see the types of patients that were enrolled in these studies based on their degree of illness and the main outcomes that were looked at. In the Qureshi study, for example, they looked at asthma score and FEV1. The Ralston, on the other hand, looked at ED length of stay. So, and what they found was that there was no discernible difference between the two treatment groups when racemic was compared to Xopenex in this setting. And then this has even been looked at more recently as a continuous form of therapy. So nebulizing racemic and nebulizing levalbuterol continuously and comparing that and seeing if there's a difference. And in fact, there wasn't. If anything, the racemic group had better improvement in FEV1 and asthma scores with no discernible difference in hospitalization. So with mild asthma, again, real common. Hopefully that some of that information was novel as far as the dosing of MDI spacer, as far as debunking Xopenex or levalbuterol. We know that short-acting beta agonists are a standard of care. I hope I've convinced you that NABs and MDI spacer are equally effective. Jury's still out on Xopenex, most of us not using it. And we'll talk about steroids with the moderately ill patient. Most of these patients, of course, are going to be able to go home. Okay, so now let's talk about the child who's a little sicker, and then we'll end up the asthma discussion with the severe patient. This is an 11-year-old who has a moderate exacerbation, and the questions I'm raising here is, what about Atrovent or ipratropium bromide in this setting? We know we're going to use corticosteroids. What form should it take? Should it be oral or IV? And if oral, which drug should we use? And then finally, a brief discussion about inhaled corticosteroids for the ED physician. And really, there's two different ways of conceptualizing that. One is, should we use it as an adjunct to systemic corticosteroid in an attempt to hasten the recovery of the patient, keep them out of the hospital? Or, conversely, if you're sending a patient home and they're not already taking inhaled corticosteroids, should you, the ED physician, be the one to prescribe it? So again, just as a reminder, we're talking about this moderately ill group right in the middle here. And the first question is about ipratropium bromide or Atrovent. So Qureshi was one of the first ones that looked at this and compared it to the placebo group. You can see her control group was treated in a standardized manner with albuterol every 20 minutes for the first three treatments and prednisone given soon after arrival. And the treatment group was treated in the same way, except they received two Atrovent treatments. So that was the only difference. Really well-designed study. Large numbers of children enrolled. You like to see that, over 400 enrolled. And in fact, when all patients were considered, the Atrovent group did show a benefit, 27% hospitalization rate versus 37%. And when looked at more carefully, it was actually the more severely ill patients who benefited, as opposed to the moderate. On the other hand, a more recent publication looked at asthma score over time for those treated with a higher dose Atrovent. And you can see over the first 4 hours, there was a lower asthma score for the Atrovent-treated patients. Lower is good. That, of course, suggests less disease. So they did get better slowly over time. This is not a drug that works very quickly. It lags behind the albuterol benefits. But most studies now are showing that you can get bronchodilation above the bronchodilation that you would get with albuterol alone by using Atrovent. In the same study, the admit rates for the Atrovent-treated patients were lower. Okay? So I think the sum total of the data, and again, time doesn't allow me to give you an exhaustive review of the literature, but trust me, this is one or two of the better studies looking at this. But it's suffice to say that Atrovent seems to benefit the more moderate or moderate to severely ill patients. Conversely, there's no proven benefit for hospitalized patients. So actually, our asthma pathway does not call for the use of Atrovent in hospitalized patients. It doesn't seem to result in a lower length of stay. And you can see recommended dosing guidelines, 500 micrograms with each of the first several albuterol treatments. Some will add it to the first two, some will add it to the first three treatments, a little bit of a lower dose for the young infant. The important take-home point here is this is safe. The early precursors were not. Patients did have anticholinergic side effects because there was a fair amount of systemic absorption. And now less than 1% of this drug is absorbed, so that's no longer an issue. It's cheap, it's safe, it seems to benefit patients. I think the risk-benefit ratio favors its use. One word of caution, if you're using the MDI form, it's contraindicated in those with soybean or peanut allergy because of a preservative in the MDI. That's not true in the nebulized form. All right, corticosteroids. Let's talk about steroids. So a million years ago when I was a fellow, I did a study that looking at the use of prednisone in acute asthma in the ED. And those of you who are not as old as I am are wondering, why did that even get approved by your IRB? I mean, really? Well, at the time, steroids were not used in the ED setting. They were only used for those who were being hospitalized. So this was among the first studies that showed a steroid benefit in the ED setting. So you could see the setup, randomized double-blind trial, 75 children. We gave 2 per kilo of prednisone, compare that to placebo. Probably there were a lot of findings that I could share with you, but I'll just boil it down to this one finding, which I think is perhaps the most important one. All of the patients in this slide would have been hospitalized at the 2-hour point had we made a decision at the 2-hour point. But we continued to monitor them and care for them for an additional 2 hours. And what we found is that more than half of those in the prednisone group who would have been hospitalized were able to go home, and none of them relapsed. None of them bounced back to the emergency department. We did not see that in the placebo group. So we found that, yes, prednisone worked, but there was a delay in its onset of action. Subsequently, Qureshi has compared Decadron to prednisone in acute asthma. Really a well-done study. Again, over 500 patients. You can see the doses of prednisone that were used, 2 per kilo in the emergency department setting, and that was compared to 0.6 milligrams per kilo in the ED setting. This study was performed in 01, so importantly, Orapred was not used. And I make that distinction because Orapred is simply better tolerated. It's more palatable than the prelone syrup or tablets that we used to use, which are really as effective as Ipecac, I think, in inducing vomiting. So, and we look at all of her outcomes, and as far as efficacy, there's really no difference between the two groups, measured in a number of different ways. How many needed to be admitted, among those who went home, what were relapse rates. But those who vomited in the ED, that was less in the Decadron group, and noncompliance rates were a lot less as well. Okay. So I think there's a growing body of literature now to support the use of dexamethasone. A very recent meta-analysis of 6 studies found no difference in ED relapse, similar to Carisci's work. Keep in mind that when we're giving that 0.6 milligrams per kilo, which has become somewhat of a standard dose for both croup and now for asthma, that's equivalent to giving 4 per kilo of prednisone. That's a pretty substantial dose of Decadron. And the oral options are variable. If you have a young child who can only take syrup, some of us will take the IV formulation, which is more concentrated and a little bit more palatable than the oral solution. And there are tablets available as well. So once again, I think everyone in the audience would agree, corticosteroids for moderate asthma, 2 thumbs up, right? This study came along, published in the New England Journal in 2009, saying, not so fast. Actually, no, our data says that it's not helpful. So there's many in the audience who may have read this paper, and I really would like to take 2 slides to discuss it to suggest that I haven't embraced these results. So 700 young children less than 60 months of age who had wheezing associated with an upper respiratory infection. They were randomized to prednisone or placebo, and they were, though, among those admitted, there was no difference in the hospital length of stay. So that was the main study outcome that was looked at. And their conclusion was that prednisone should not be given to preschool children with acute, mild to moderate virus-induced wheezing. And that's a pretty profound statement. That really, if we embrace those results, would revolutionize the way we treat children with asthma in the ED setting. And again, 700 children published in the New England Journal. But really a lot of problems with this study if we critique it carefully. First of all, most of the patients were fairly mildly ill, and that was borne out by the mean initial asthma score, which was only 4 for these children. Probably a lot of them had bronchiolitis, and as we'll talk about, I'm not convinced that corticosteroids are efficacious in the treatment of bronchiolitis. 80% of these young, wheezing children with URI had never wheezed before, so a fair number of them no doubt had bronchiolitis. Very low doses of prednisone were used, and that wasn't well explained. And the protocol allowed for placebo patients to get treated with more albuterol, which would have driven the results to the null hypothesis. So we reject this study. We continue to use steroids. I think most in the audience would agree and are still using steroids in that setting. What about inhaled corticosteroids? Once again, we said there may be 2 particular ways that you might use this. One is to treat the acute asthma flare-up in the emergency department, add it to your armamentarium, so to speak, and then at ED discharge. Is that a role for an ED physician? The data to support the use of inhaled corticosteroids in the ED setting isn't very strong. We did look at this a while back, looking at nebulized dexamethasone and finding no real benefit compared to oral prednisone. So in that study, it was the inhaled versus systemic. And then one of our fellows more recently published this information where the systemic prednisone was compared to systemic plus inhaled, in this case, budesonide being used. And we looked at a number of outcome measures, hospitalization rates, clinical asthma scores, and there was no difference in any of those outcome measures. Getting back to the question about what about the role of ED physicians, and I've kind of come full circle on this issue. Not too long ago, I felt it really wasn't my role. I didn't feel comfortable prescribing a medication that would be used chronically, not knowing if my patients would circle back with their pediatricians or not, and really a little bit worried about the side effect profile. I think what's really changed for me is the longitudinal studies now showing that inhaled corticosteroids are, in fact, safe, even when used long-term. And there really isn't a significant impact on long-term growth, long-term achievement of height, which had been one of the main concerns. These drugs are mostly topically active. There's very little systemic absorption. And so you're not going to have systemic side effects with the use of a medication like fluticasone or budesonide. We sent out a survey to pediatric emergency medicine physicians, and we presented two fictitious cases to them. One was a 2-year-old, and the other was a 15-year-old that had persistent asthma, that were treated successfully in the emergency department, and then were being sent home after that treatment. And we asked these physicians, how often in that setting would you prescribe a controller medication? How often would you prescribe inhaled corticosteroids to these patients upon ED discharge? And I think of note in that far right bar, about 15% said more than half the time. So they weren't prescribing it, and the age of the patient did not matter to them. It wasn't that they were worried about prescribing it to the very young and the impact on growth. That wasn't the issue. It was that they weren't really seeing it as their role. But I've become, like I said, I can't be change my practice in this way, in this regard. I've been swayed and gone over to the other side. So, and I'm not doing it so much to impact their relapse rates. I'm not convinced that there's evidence to support that. When you're using systemic corticosteroids at ED discharge, it's really the issue of getting them started on a controller med to impact their, you know, the future number of exacerbations. And so, you know, the NIH guidelines are now recommending that we should consider it. And I agree with that. So you've successfully managed this moderately ill patient, and now you're trying to determine home versus admission to the hospital. You're going to throw a lot of things into that decision-making, the child's exam. You're going to factor in their past medical history as well, at least I do. You know, how many times have they been hospitalized? Is this a labile patient? You may factor in the social support. You know, how much do you trust the caretaker to deliver the medications? And then you'll make a decision. When you're sending the patient home, I would urge you, and I've outlined in yellow perhaps some of the novel features of this management, for those older kids, use an adequate number of puffs of MDI spacer. It never made sense to me to use two puffs in the 18-month-old and in the 18-year-old. It just doesn't make sense. And I think we've been behind the eight ball on this issue. The British Thoracic Society, most of Europe has been doing this for several decades. Comparatively, this is still a very low dose compared to what you put in that nebulizer reservoir. So use an adequate amount when you send them home with MDI spacer. I think I've showed you that either prednisone or decadron are each reasonable options, both in the ED setting as well as ED discharge. And then, as we talked about, persistent asthma, think about starting the inhaled corticosteroids. Now we'll turn to the more severely ill patient who's very dyspneic, very tachypneic, has perhaps an oxygen requirement, is retracting deeply, significant worker breathing, really worrisome on initial arrival. That's the type of child that if you have a resuscitation room is going to be brought there, and you really want to act quickly on this patient. Go ahead and give her oxygen. Consider the non-rebreathing face mask. You're going to start a short-acting beta agonist as soon as you can. This is a patient who's probably going to need an IV anyway, so pop a line in, give her the steroids through the IV. She may well, just from her respiratory distress, she may well vomit anything administered orally. And so the initial management may look a lot like for the patient with the moderately ill exacerbation. But the question becomes, what else can we offer her? We really want to impact on her severity of disease, and what else is available? And one is either sub-Q or intramuscular therapy. So in the previous talk, Doug Baker mentioned, and rightly so, that for anaphylaxis, we're using IM therapy. The reason I hedge here and mention both is because if you turn to most of our textbooks, they're still recommending sub-Q therapy for this, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think it's going to change soon. I suspect that when the drug is delivered by the IM route, you'd get enhanced absorption and distribution of the drug because of the vascular bed of the muscle. And so for a very rapid response, go ahead and give sub-Q or IM therapy. Indications are listed here, but again, it's that dyspneic patient who you think is not getting delivery of the aerosolized medication to the distal airways because they're so tight. And so sometimes, if logistics allow, I'll go ahead and give this even before the nebulizer therapy is started, just as soon as they hit the door and as soon as we can get it drawn up and available to them. The question becomes which drug. Most of you out there are using epinephrine, and that's fine. It's readily available. You can just go ahead and use the EpiPen and give the appropriate dose, either EpiPen Junior or EpiPen. 30 kilos is the cutoff there. The advantage of tributyline, theoretic advantage, is that it is more beta-selective, and because you're expecting less vasoconstriction, perhaps you're getting better delivery, systemic delivery of the drug. So others would use tributyline. It's the same dosing as epinephrine. Really not good data comparing these two. Another trick up your sleeve is to turn to continuously nebulized albuterol. And again, most studies here, and I'm just showing you the tip of a bigger iceberg, but most studies support that. This happened to be a systemic review of 8 different trials, only 2 of which included children, but a good number of patients, continuously treated patients, did have better outcomes, including lower admit rates. And so really that's an easy decision. Go ahead and just set up the patient continuously. This is a good time to pause, so to speak, and just talk a little bit about summarizing what we've discussed with respect to short-acting beta agonists. We've already talked about the mild patient. You know that. The moderately ill patient, what we tend to do frequently in our emergency department is to take 3 nebulized treatments, put that together with Atrovent in the same reservoir, and run that over an hour for the patients who are moderately ill. And we call that a uni-neb, but we do that over an hour. So theoretically or technically it is a continuous form of treatment, but it's only running for an hour, and then we reassess the patient. And we do that not because it's more efficacious than MDI spacer. I think I showed you earlier and proved to you that that's not the case. We do it for logistics reasons. The NIH says, hey, give 3 treatments within 60 minutes of the patient hitting the door. And when you try to do that intermittently, whether it's NEB or MDI spacer, it's very difficult to achieve that. You get busy with other patients, as does your nursing staff and respiratory therapy. It's just very difficult to achieve that. So this is a way around that. You just figure out how much would you give this patient by weight, 1 treatment, triple that, put it in the reservoir, add saline, add Atrovent, 2 rounds of Atrovent or 3, and just run it over an hour. It's a really nice way to do it. And then that's separate from the severe patient, which we just outlined, where you're going to be fairly aggressive giving IM or sub-Q therapy. You're going to start continuous, have a low threshold for starting continuous, and that continuous is going to be run over many hours. This is a kid who's going to be admitted, so just continue that while in the hospital. And there are some dosing guidelines there for that, either 10, 15, or 20 milligrams an hour, depending on the weight of the patient. So now you've gone ahead and intervened in this way that we just outlined for the severe patient, and you're wondering, what else can we offer this kid? She's still sick. Her asthma score went from 12 to 10, so she's getting better, but she's still pretty sick. And so what about magnesium? Now, we studied this, and in our study, we did not find a magnesium benefit compared to placebo. But the important thing about this study was that these were not albuterol unresponsive patients. We took moderately ill patients, and right when they hit the door, they either got albuterol, pred, and magnesium, or albuterol and pred. So we didn't have them declare themselves as beta agonist unresponsive. And we gave the magnesium, and in that setting, we did not see a magnesium benefit, either by virtue of asthma score or by hospitalization rates. But others have looked at a beta agonist unresponsive group, not better after 2 or 3 albuterol treatments, and then randomized them to mag or not, and have found the benefit, especially among the most severely ill patients. And this was a meta-analysis of almost 700 patients looking at that and finding that when you looked at admit rates, when you looked at pulmonary function tests, the severely ill patients did have a statistically significant benefit from magnesium. So again, we're not really sure why magnesium works. We think it has to do with calcium influx into smooth muscles. but it's a relatively safe drug. A caveat, if you're going to use it, is give it over about 20 minutes. If you give it more rapidly than that, the patient will drop their blood pressure. It's usually not a clinically significant drop in blood pressure, but you may need to give them an extra fluid bolus in response to that. But give it over 20 minutes, and you should be fine. To my knowledge, there isn't good data to support the continuous use of magnesium beyond that initial 20 minutes. I think that's a study that needs to be done. It would be intriguing and important for us to know if you can have a sustained benefit when mag is used in that setting. Again, turning to the literature, what else can we offer this patient? And this young resident is concluding that what about IV beta agonist? And that is something that we will often turn to, like, for example, IV tributyline. Surprisingly, the literature supporting that is very, very weak. I could only find three very small studies that had the design that I was looking for, which is to say, oh, you've got this very sick kid who's already getting continuous albuterol, and now you want to add IV therapy on top of that, and let's compare that group of patient to the group that's only getting inhaled therapy. And you can see this is very scant numbers here, 29, 46, 29 adults or children. So not a lot to guide us in our decision making. And only one of those studies really found a profound benefit. The good news is that children tolerate beta agonist well, even children who are receiving concurrently continuously nebulized albuterol as well as a drug like IV tributyline. They tolerate it well. We usually don't see significant dysrhythmias or adverse effects, cardiovascular effects. And it's the type of thing that if your patient is really sick and you're trying to avoid intubation, you may decide to turn to this. IV tributyline, again, is the drug that most of us would use in this setting. You can see the recommended dosing guidelines. You can start your infusion relatively high, 0.3 to 0.5 mics per kilo per minute. And then, as we've been emphasizing throughout the morning, titrate to your patient's needs. So let 30 minutes or so go by, and then titrate to the patient's needs. There are other tricks up your sleeve, other considerations. I think it's safe to say that most of these fall under the heading of non-standard therapy. So, again, data is lacking. Heliox is one example of that. So theoretically, with the use of Heliox, it's a more laminar flow of air, and you can get better delivery of albuterol to the distal airways. But the studies that have done are quite small, really pilot studies at this point. And then BiPAP. Anecdotally, I've had really good success with BiPAP in a number of very sick asthmatic patients, and so I've become a big fan of bilateral positive airway pressure. So it can theoretically help in several ways, but with inhalation, it decreases the pressure needed for that patient to take a breath, to initiate a breath. And with exhalation, it's helping to prevent alveolar collapse. And so it's really a nice choice, and therefore you're theoretically improving VQ mismatch. You know, it's the type of thing that if you apply it and the patient is fighting it and not tolerating it, you're going to know right away and you can just abort. But most children, especially the older ones, will get some relief and will want to keep it on as a result. And this is to show that it can be used even among very small children. They'll tolerate it pretty nicely. Again, the evidence supporting it is not the best in the world. I like to give evidence-based approach to what I recommend, but this was a study that looked at 83 young children who were very sick. They were all supposed to go to the PICU. BiPAP was tried on all 83, and 88% of them tolerated the BiPAP, and of those, 16 were able to get well enough in the ED that they avoided going to the PICU. And you can see large percentages of them had decreased respiratory rate and increase in their oxygen saturation after BiPAP. Not the best data we'll ever have, but again, that coupled with my anecdotal experience, I've become a fan. What about intubating? So here's this resident, he's been in the NICU, and he's been intubating these young babies, but they don't have teeth, and he wants to intubate someone with teeth, right? So let's go ahead and intubate. Well, just be very, very wary about intubating the child with asthma. Understand that you really want to have very clear guidelines for doing so. Certainly progressively worsening hypercapnia or if you can't oxygenate the patient, certainly that's a consideration, the patient with altered mental status, bradycardia. I would urge you to not do so based on a single blood gas result, especially if that blood gas is obtained very early in the patient's clinical course, soon after arrival, because like the child who's in status epilepticus, I don't want to know what that blood gas is minutes after arrival. I haven't done anything. I haven't intervened. Perhaps after I've intervened, I'll get a blood gas and see where am I now, and you know, and then 4 hours down the road when the patient is thought to be worsening in the PICU, that blood gas can be repeated, and then you can compare objective data. And if you are going to intubate such a patient, think about being careful to not cause barotrauma. So there's this concept of permissive hypercapnia with a mechanically ventilated child with asthma. So you're not trying to achieve the perfect blood gas. And I would just work very closely with my respiratory therapy and PICU colleagues with a patient like this. Thankfully, it's been many years since I've had to intubate a child with asthma. We see a fair number of very sick children with asthma, as I'm sure you do as well. So these guys successfully muddled through this case and without intubating this patient and trying these measures. So now we're going to talk about bronchiolitis. And so this is an outline or an overview of what we'll talk about in this phase of the lecture. We'll talk about the management, a little bit about treatment options and disposition of the baby with bronchiolitis. So fundamentally, what you like to do is decide, does my child have asthma or does my child have bronchiolitis? But unfortunately, too many patients have asthmolitis, don't they? Where they have overlapping signs and features that can be seen in either disease. And that can be challenging. And I think it is important to try to make a clinical distinction of what you're dealing with, because as I'll describe, once again, if you think your child has bronchiolitis, probably the sum total of the literature that's out there doesn't support using corticosteroids in that setting. So one of the first management questions that arises is chest radiographs, right? Our students, our residents, they always want to get chest films. You know, that six-month-old with a temp of 38.2 who's wheezing, let's get a chest film, right? It's a knee-jerk response. But Suzanne Hsu out of Toronto said not so fast. It's actually probably counterproductive to do so. So this was a really clever study, looking at a large number of these infants, 265 with bronchiolitis. They'd all been treated with albuterol, and every one of them then had a chest x-ray. And the ED physicians caring for these patients were asked before the x-ray was obtained, would you use antibiotics in this patient for whatever reason? And also, what's your disposition for the patient, home or admit? This is pre-x-ray. And then after the x-ray, they were asked those same questions. So 265 patients, you can see the overwhelming majority of them had either a normal film or 17 in the middle there had atelectasis, which for all intents and purposes is normal. There were only two children with abnormal films. So the likelihood of uncovering an unsuspected diagnosis in this series was very low. And as I said, it was somewhat counterproductive because look at how the antibiotic use went up in the pre versus post chest x-ray films, post chest x-ray assessment. And the reason, no doubt, is because ED docs like me are looking at a little schmutz on the x-ray and saying, oh, that's probably pneumonia, let's start antibiotics, when in fact it's not. And so, and the intended disposition for these patients was not changed either. What about viral testing? I think this is all about cost versus benefit. Where I work, we have the ability to send a panel to send, you know, respiratory secretions from the nasopharynx for a panel, a long list of viruses that can be detected by PCR. The problem is it costs $5,000. So is that cost effective? And more, the answer I think is no, and studies are showing that. You can consider it in certain scenarios. It may be important in your hospital for cohorting, for example. But I would suggest that maybe cohorting by clinical syndrome is a better way to go. Does it matter if your patient has RSV or adenovirus or metapneumovirus that's inducing their bronchiolitis? And what if we just said, well, this patient has clinical bronchiolitis and needs to be cohorted on that basis? Probably more cost-effective to do it that way. You may be familiar with these practice guidelines that were published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and these were published in 06. And you can see that, among other things, it was stated clinicians should not routinely order lab and radiological studies for diagnosis. And, you know, I would agree with that. And, again, the slides that I just showed you, I think, supports that. There's a subset of patients that's worth spending a few minutes on, and that is the child who has either RSV or clinical bronchiolitis and is less than 2 months of age, so the febrile young infant. And should that patient be managed differently because, well, after all, I have a potential source for my fever. My patient has bronchiolitis. So Levine led a multicenter study that looked at a large number of these babies under 60 days of age. A third of them were neonates, less than a month old, and looked at those with RSV and wanted to compare serious bacterial infection rates for those who were positive versus those who were negative for RSV. And on this slide on the far right are all patients, and you can see when all forms of serious bacterial infection were considered, those who are RSV negative in blue, the likelihood of them having a serious bacterial infection was quite a bit higher than the RSV positive patients in red. But having said that, a fair number, as much as 7% of those RSV positive febrile babies had a serious bacterial infection. So it was less than their RSV negative counterparts, but by no means was it zero. The good news for us as clinicians is most of that positivity was driven by rates of UTI. So there were low rates of bacteremia and no cases of meningitis. Having said that, the study was not powered to detect significant differences in rates of meningitis, and we should keep that in mind when we're interpreting these results. But this was RSV positive versus negative. And then Levine further looked at a subset of neonates. So now these are babies who are less than a month of age, 411 such babies, and now that profound difference kind of disappears a little bit. Now the RSV negative and positive groups are starting to be a little more similar in their rates of positivity of serious bacterial infections. So once again, neonates can't be trusted. They're not trustworthy. And then this was a review of 11 studies, and here now we're looking at either babies who had clinical bronchiolitis or documented RSV infection. So they may or may not have had documented RSV disease, but included here was a mix of those with clinical bronchiolitis. And Ralston just simply wanted to look at SBI rates among these 1,700 patients. And he found 3+% had UTI. It was a very small number with bacteremia and no cases of meningitis in these 1,700 patients. So what's the bottom line? Well, a true statement is that serious bacterial infection is less common among those with bronchiolitis. I would say that for the neonate, as we discussed, go ahead and do what you would normally do. If it's your normal standard practice to do a full sepsis workup, which includes a spinal tap, then by all means go ahead and do that. Don't let the presence of wheezing or clinical bronchiolitis or even RSV positivity sway you from that. Neonates can't be trusted. The child who's a little older, 1 to 2 months, this is more of a gray zone. I think there is a lot of interpretation of that literature. I would tend to send a urine culture, as we talked about, a UAN culture. 7% of these babies can be expected to have coexisting pylo. The jury is still out about whether or not you need to routinely do blood and or CSF analysis in those patients. I'll leave that up to you. I gave you the data, and it's possible for different clinicians to look at that same data and come to different conclusions. And then again, once again, I think there's some greater clarity for the older kids over 2 months of age with fever. Yay for urine if there's risk factors, probably no routine role for getting a CBC and or a blood culture in that group, assuming they're not ill or toxic appearing. What about therapies? Now we need to treat So far we've said we can't do any viral testing. We can't do any chest x-rays. Can we do some treatment at least? Well, these are all the effective bronchiolitis therapies. This is the whole list of effective bronchiolitis therapy. I hate bronchiolitis, right? It's such a frustrating disease. The news isn't quite that bad. The AAP guidelines say that bronchodilators, corticosteroids, ribavirin, and antibiotics should not be used routinely. So where's the fun here? We're doctors. We want to do something, right? We want to make these patients better. How are we going to make them better? Uh-oh, that's not showing up very well. Here we go. That's better. So this was Gadomski, who looked at a number of studies looking at short-acting beta agonists in bronchiolitis. This is a busy slide, but the top half shows inpatient studies and the bottom half outpatient studies. You see that line in the center. The more to the left of the line the results are, that favored the treatment. That favored better outcomes with the use of albuterol. And the more to the right, that favored placebo. And I think just that looking at it in this way, most of the studies found a very, very modest benefit with albuterol use. Okay? And there's that line that outlined it. On the other hand, similar studies were used looking at racemic epinephrine and, here we go, nebulized racemic epi. And here, the results are not what I just showed you, but in fact, most of the studies are showing no benefit with the use of racemic epi compared to short-acting beta agonists like albuterol. Okay? So what about the use of systemic corticosteroids? So you may be familiar with the PCARN study, which was a double-blind randomized trial, large number of patients, 600 with moderate to severe disease with bronchiolitis, and they were randomized to either oral dex or placebo. And the results can't get much more similar than this, right? With respect to the main study outcome, which was the admit rates, the overall hospitalization rates. So I think this study kind of emphatically says there is really no benefit, short-term benefit, to the use of oral corticosteroids in this setting when the goal is to decrease hospitalizations. Then our colleagues in Canada published a double-blind randomized control trial. They looked at 800 patients with bronchiolitis, and they had four different treatment arms. And here you can see the leftmost column were the patients that were treated only with placebo. And you can see there was certainly a difference and a benefit for those that received a combination of Decadron and racemic epinephrine compared to the double placebo group. One of the struggles that I have with using racemic epi in the ED is, in my mind, I've pretty much committed that patient to a hospitalization because I'm not comfortable giving a drug like racemic epi, which I know to be short-acting, and which I know the family can't give at home. So even if the patient has a benefit in the ED setting, I'm not comfortable sending that patient home at that stage. So there are lots of remaining questions, lots of different things on the list that still require study, including hypertonic saline. You'll see studies in the literature on the use of hypertonic saline or BiPAP. Ribavirin is another that's kind of fallen out of favor. It's been many, many years since I've used ribavirin. I don't know why this is coming in like this. It's just decided to come in one line at a time, so just bear with it. Sorry about that. Okay, so apnea is one of the main things that we're concerned about when we're taking care of the very young bronchiolitic patient. I think this study was very helpful in defining who precisely we should be worried about. This was a study of 700 inpatients, and 3% of them had apnea while in the hospital. So right away, recognize that this is a select subset of patients. These were those kids sick enough to be hospitalized. And who gets apnea? Well, the young ones, less than a month of age. That should say less than 38 weeks gestation, so the preemies. And those who came in where mom reported a history of apnea at home prior to ED arrival. If you were among the 429 without any of those risk factors, none of those developed apnea while in the hospital, so 100% negative predictive value. And then who can be safely sent home? You know, this study was published in 08, and you can see the list, and basically it kind of complements what I just showed you. So the older kids who aren't preemies, who look reasonably well in the emergency department, usually can safely be sent home. So how do we tie this all together? So you want to go ahead and assess the severity of illness. On the left side, if you're dealing with a child who's very mild, then I think it's reasonable in most cases to go ahead and just discharge the patient home, probably not even giving a bronchodilator in the emergency department setting. On the other hand, off on the right, you have the patient who's more moderate or moderate to severely ill. You can kind of group them under, hey, this kid needs to get better before he's going to be able to go home. And in that case, what I usually do is a single dose of racemic albuterol to see what the response is. If there's a desired response, a significant improvement, and if that improvement is sustained after 1 or 2 hours of observation in the ED, that patient could probably go home, and I would usually send them home with beta agonist because they demonstrated a response to it. On the other hand, if you have a patient who's not improved, then those kids need to come in. And it's up to you whether you want to try racemic epi in that setting. I tend to do so, and then I can turn to the floor team and say, you know, this child did in fact get better with racemic epi. It may be a consideration. It may be something you want to continue during the course of the hospitalization. But I think most of our inpatient colleagues now have embraced the concept that there really does have to be a proven benefit to either the beta agonist or the racemic epi for it to be continued. Otherwise, you're really admitting them for supportive care, for hydration, for oxygenation, and close observation. Okay. The final topic then in the lower airway disease talk here is community-acquired pneumonia. And many of my comments are going to be adhering to the Infectious Disease Society guidelines that were recently published. This was in 2011, and also the British Thoracic Society guidelines published here also in 2011. So what about bacterial etiology? Really fundamentally, we want to think about this in terms of the age of the patient. And your younger patients, obviously, pneumococcus is our main concern, the main player. Non-typeable H flu is going to be much less frequent. And then the older children and adolescents, mycoplasma comes into play as well as pneumococcus. Okay, so that's the bacterial etiology. And we have to know what we're faced with if we're going to make intelligent decisions about antibiotic choice. Again, what about chest x-rays in these patients? I feel like I can give you really good guidance about when to obtain a urine sample on the febrile young patient. And I can give you good guidance about when to do an LP and when you can safely omit an LP. I'm not so sure I can do the same about chest radiographs. In my career, I've seen too many children who look reasonably well, who have a cough and a snotty nose and a low-grade fever, and they look like every other child with a viral URI. And for one reason or another, a chest x-ray is obtained, and they have a big round pneumonia. And you see that big round pneumonia on x-ray, and you go and examine them and put your stethoscope right on that spot, and you can't hear it. And it's probably because they're not able to take deep breaths and move a lot of air. So pneumonias can be pretty clinically silent. And what's the solution to that, to get chest x-rays in all those snotty nose, you know, febrile patients? Of course not. So it's really tough. You know, those of us on the front lines, everyone in this audience knows how tough it can be. These guidelines are saying that routine chest x-rays are not necessary for the confirmation of suspected pneumonia. Basically, what they're saying is clinicians go ahead and feel comfortable making the diagnosis of clinical pneumonia. And the problem with that, of course, is we're going to be overcalling it. I would venture to guess that for every 10 children that we start on antibiotics for clinical pneumonia, maybe one's going to have it. So it remains difficult. I do look for focal exams. I do look for grunting. I do look for work of breathing. The height of the fever. Most kids with pneumococcal pneumonia have a very high fever. But understand and I appreciate that there's a lot of clinical overlap there. But just so you know, these are what the guidelines say. What about testing for pathogens? It's really difficult to uncover an etiology for pneumonia in these young children. Many might say, well, what about getting a blood culture? Well, the yield for outpatients, those who are not ill enough to be hospitalized, is going to be quite low. And really, the yield for inpatients is not much better, on the order of about 5%. Having said that, you know, most of our patients who are going to be admitted for IV antibiotics, they're getting a line anyway. So sure, go ahead and send the blood culture, but just understand the yield is going to be fairly low. Our children are not producing sputum, so good luck with testing that. And then again, I'm not a fan of viral pathogen testing for the reasons that we talked about earlier, just the cost issue. And I'm not convinced that it changes management all that much as far as the length of stay. But again, that's contrary to what the guidelines are saying, as you see, that it should be used in the evaluation of children with community-acquired pneumonia. Consider testing for mycoplasma. Mycoplasma is another big headache, isn't it, as we'll talk about, because that older kid who you're entertaining the diagnosis of mycoplasma, do you need to add Zithromax or not? We'll talk about that. Oh, we're going to talk about that now, apparently. So I was hoping not to have to talk about it. So atypical pneumonia, caused by mycobacteria. When should we be thinking about it? It's, as we know, a more indolent onset of disease. It's a child who's been sick for a couple of days before coming to medical attention. Malaise, sore throat is a hallmark of it in many cases, low-grade fever. It's generally not the three-year-old who, I've had a cold for a day, and now I have a temp of 39.8, and I'm really sick and not feeling so well. It's generally not that patient. It's the 8-year-old with the sore throat and headache and malaise and a temp of 101 and a cough and, you know, may or may not have asymmetry on exam. That generally, very generally, is the case for mycoplasma pneumonia. These guidelines are not very helpful, though, because they are pointing out that younger children, in fact, can have mycoplasma, and the age at which you should begin to strongly consider it is really not well-defined. One of the challenges is some of us might say, okay, I'm just going to use Zithromax. I'm good. I'm going to use Zithromax. I'm going to cover mycoplasma, and I'm going to cover pneumococcus. It's not a good pneumococcus drug. Too much resistance. So it becomes a problem for us. So empiric therapy for outpatients. One of the things that, if you can, is to try to make a clinical determination of whether you're dealing with bacterial or atypical pneumonia. If you're confident you're dealing with bacterial and you have the young child, high-dose Amox is the drug of choice. The older child, it becomes a little bit more problematic. High-dose Amox, definitely. A macrolide might or can be added per the guidelines. So most of us aren't really happy about using two different antibiotics, right, to treat bacterial pneumonia. So I think you have to make your best judgment based on the clinical scenario that you're confronted with. Over on the right, if you're more confident that this is an atypical pneumonia, then go ahead and use the macrolide antibiotic. Again, as I said, high-dose Amox remains the drug of choice. And in fact, it's superior to second or third generation oral cephalosporins in this setting. So don't think that by starting a cephalosporin, you're giving enhanced coverage. For pneumococcus, that's generally not the case. And then, as we know, patients with allergies come in kind of different flavors. You have the non-serious or the non-type 1 allergies to Amox, and you can use one of those cephalosporins listed there. And then, of course, with the type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, you're not going to use a cephalosporin, and there are some options there, including Clinda. And then you have that sicker patient who may need to be admitted. That, of course, is the patient who may have an oxygen requirement. Perhaps they have extreme work of breathing. They might have failed oral therapy in your emergency department. They've vomited their oral antibiotic, or perhaps they've been on an oral antibiotic for a few days and they're still sick. So those are the patients that are going to need to be hospitalized. IV ampicillin is the drug of choice. Many of us in our practices have been using ceftriaxone, but the guidelines are emphasizing that IV amp is the drug of choice. Community-acquired pneumonia, think pneumococcus, right? When should we consider broader therapy? There's a long list here. If there's high pneumococcal resistance in your community, consider it in the unimmunized population. And if you're seeing a lot of MRSA, or if you have reason to suspect that this very ill patient has MRSA, then you're going to need to add coverage for MRSA. So as with the outpatient, we'll try to summarize the therapy for the inpatient. If you're dealing with a neonate who has what looks to be a pneumonia, then AMP and cefotax is recommended. If they happen to be less than 3 weeks of age, have a low threshold for adding acyclovir, thinking about disseminated HSV disease and the pneumonitis that those kids can get. If, on the other hand, it's the straightforward, previously well patient, community-acquired pneumonia, sick enough to come in, high-dose IV AMP is recommended. If you have that patient who you're worried about aspiration, then a drug like Unison or Clinda would be a good choice. And then the very sick patients who are going to the PICU, broader coverage with the third-generation cephalosporin, and consider Vanco, especially if you're worried about MRSA. So have these guidelines resulted in significant changes in practice? Well, in Kansas City, the answer was yes. So this was a very nice study of actually 1,000 patients, 500 before and 500 after these guidelines were published. And you can see the difference in the rates of ampicillin that was used relative to ceftriaxone after publication of the guidelines. So guidelines do work, and they are followed. At least the good folks in Kansas City are doing so. And what about pleural effusion, a paraneumonic effusion? If there's just an effusion, of course, that means there's fluid, and empyema suggests pus and would be loculated. For most of my training, to help me decide whether or not a patient had pus or not, whether it was loculated, we were getting CTs, CTs of the chest. It's an enormous amount of radiation. It's about 300 to 400 chest radiographs worth of radiation, a single chest CT. So thankfully now we're no longer doing that, and ultrasound has become our imaging modality of choice. And it's actually, my radiology colleagues tell me, better for determining whether there's loculation or not compared to CT. So we're using chest ultrasounds. The management, if you have a straightforward effusion, then go ahead and insert a chest tube. This decision really should be largely based on the degree of respiratory distress that the patient is in, not based on the size of the effusion, not based on a guess of how many cc's of fluid is in that space. So again, if there are no loculations, go ahead and place the chest tube. The patient with loculation may need to undergo the VATS procedure. And again, patients in this who are this ill with an effusion or empyema, broad spectrum coverage here, I would be worried specifically about staph infection in the patient with an effusion. So this has kind of been a whirlwind tour of lower airway emergencies. There's lots of references, and you can start reading them now. Thank you.
Great. While we wait for Dr. Baker to make his way up, thank you. That was a fantastic review of, feels like, a lot of what we do every day. I'm happy to hear the continued dissemination of the nihilistic approach to bronchiolitis. I started an albuterol anonymous club for folks who were tempted to give albuterol to bronchiolitic patients, and then they could call me and I would talk them down and say that they would be okay. I was part of a quality improvement thing, and we got us down to less than 5% for albuterol in the ED.
Nice.
And we also sent kids home on oxygen in Colorado as well, because we're all high as a kite and don't know what the hell we're doing. Okay. Here we have a lot of questions, and the first question is for Dr. Baker. How long do you observe a child in the emergency department after giving racemic epinephrine for croup?
That's good. This mic is on. Good question. The wrong answer is to give the epinephrine and then send them home right away. And that's been done, and I review cases sometimes to help physicians who have been sued. And there are two that I've actually been a defense expert for in that regard. It's not as uncommon as you might think. Look, epinephrine will work on everybody. It'll make everybody feel better who's got some airway congestion. It's a very good vasoconstrictor. It works quickly. It lasts a short period of time, probably half an hour or so. The infamous rebound phenomenon is probably more myth than not. What rebound implies is that you're worse after you've been eventually get worse than you started after you received the treatment. There was one anecdotal reference to a child with that type of symptomatology back in the 70s that I could uncover in an old article, and none since then that I could find. But what does happen is that the epinephrine wears off. And it'll wear off within 30 minutes, 45 minutes, maybe an hour if you're lucky, and it has a really more prolonged effect occasionally. But I think you're obligated, and I think the literature supports this, that you're obligated to watch those kids for at least a couple of hours after you give the racemic epinephrine. Nan Kunkel's article suggested probably 2 or 3 hours. She actually, the protocol was for 4. I think 4 is a long time. The other important thing to keep in mind is that if you get, if you have a child who gets better with epinephrine, and they typically will, those who will remain better never quite get worse again. They stay better to some extent, some substantial extent, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours afterwards. You will see the kids who are going to get worse will start getting worse after a couple of hours. And so please at least 2 hours. You know, the literature would suggest maybe 3 or 4, but I think at least 2.
Another question on the topic of croup is, do you give parents a prescription for a repeat dose of Decadron to give in 24 to 36 hours?
The infamous how long do you treat with Decadron question. I don't know the right answer to that. I don't know that anybody knows the correct answer to that. I am a fatalist, and so when it comes to prescribing antibiotics, I will prescribe 10 days thinking they'll take 5. That's a realistic approach to life. If I'm seeing a kid with croup and we give a dose of dexamethasone in the ED and, you know, we're thinking that's going to work, and it should, right, it should help, do we give a repeat dose to go? We typically will, but, again, I don't know that the literature hard and fast says you have to do that. Rich, I'm sure you have practice experience and you can comment as well from Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, I agree with you, Doug, that it's up to the individual. There isn't good guidance in the literature. I usually take advantage of the fact that Decadron is so long-acting and croup is such a short-lived disease, so usually I'm comfortable just giving the dose in the emergency department in most cases and not sending the children home with an additional dose.
Dr. Scarfone, how do you correlate nebulized doses of albuterol with MDIs? I don't feel clinically we can compare them milligram to milligram.
I completely agree with you. You know, it's interesting, the 20-plus studies that I showed you in the Cochrane Review, the ratio of the amount of albuterol in the small-volume nebulizer versus the MDI studies, in some cases that ratio was 2-to-1. In some cases it was 7-to-1. So it's really all over the map. And the best that we can say is that when you put the drug in the reservoir, lots of it is lost to the environment, as much as 90% of it, that MDIs are a more efficient way of delivering the drug to the alveoli. And rather than trying to compare on a milligram-to-milligram basis, I think we have to look at outcomes instead. And that's what most of those studies have tried to do.
There's a few questions on prednisone or prednisolone versus Decadron, and your thoughts on how you manage those patients as outpatients with 5 days of prednisone versus 2 versus 3 doses of Decadron, and that decision.
Sure. I guess I'm still somewhat old school in this regard with respect to prednisone. I think I've had better success with Orapred than certainly the prelone, as we talked about during the lecture. It's very inexpensive and now better tolerated. So for the most part, I'm still, and logistically, it's a little harder for us to give the IV form of Decadron in our emergency department. So most of our patients, and as our asthma protocol and our asthma pathway still calls for most of our patients in the emergency department to receive prednisone. And as a result, most of us, therefore, are continuing that for the outpatient. The patient is well enough to go home, and it's BID dosing anywhere for 3 to 5 days post-ED discharge. Having said all of that, I think if in your setting it's not logistically difficult for you to give Decadron, the data would suggest that it's very reasonable to go ahead and give go down that pathway. The studies that have compared the two were not equipotent doses of the two drugs, so a little bit of an unfair comparison perhaps. So perhaps the outcomes would have been the same had 4 per kilo of prednisone been compared to the 0.6 of the Decadron.
A couple more asthma questions. One looks at, is there a role for Xopenex in children with asthma and heart disease because it may have less tachycardic effects?
Yeah, I think that in my setting, in my practice setting, I see that a lot, actually. I see many of our patients who are followed by cardiology and who also have asthma that are on Xopenex, but I'm not sure that's well thought out. Again, the biggest downside is the expense. It's quite a bit more costly than racemic albuterol. And once again, if you want a lower side effect profile, then you have to choose a dose that's not likely to be as efficacious as, you know, as I pointed out during the lecture. So let's say you have a child who's older and would normally get 5 milligrams of albuterol in a nebulizer. Let's say that's their home therapy nebulizer as opposed to MDI spacer. Then to achieve that same efficacy, you would have to give 2.5 of the Xopenex, and the side effect profile there is going to be the same. The only way you can have a lower side effect profile is by giving the 1.25 dose, but then your efficacy is going to be half. So if that, you know, that makes sense. I think for me, if you want fewer side effects, give half the racemic albuterol dose at a substantially lower cost.
There's a few different questions on using Decadron and the preparation of Decadron and knowing some of the issues around palatability. Do you use the IM preparation orally? I tell you, at our institution, we just grind up tablets and put them in something palatable, but that's not available in all settings. So any comments?
Agreed. The oral solution doesn't taste good at all and won't be well tolerated, so I would frown upon that. The two choices beyond that is to take the IV solution and give that orally, or to take the tablets and mix it with chocolate syrup or some such solution.
There's also a comment that an audience member thought that the preservative in the MDI for Atrovent's been changed to allow for peanut allergic patients, and it was true with previous CFC inhalers. But
interesting, I wasn't aware of that. I'll have to look into that.
I will tell you one of the things that I will warn you about an Atrovent nebulizer is if it goes intraocular, it can fix and dilate that pupil.
That's right.
And so you can have a blown pupil in an asthma patient running up and, you know, and you go, yeah, that's fabulous, fabulous. Dr. Scarfone, what do you think about the use of aminophylline infusions in severe asthma? Has that ship sank?
It's funny. My first job was in 1998. And my first patient was a child with asthma, and the nurse wanted to know what dose of IV aminophylline I wanted to give. And I said, I don't want to give IV aminophylline. And she looked at me like I had 7 heads, and she said, we always give IV aminophylline for patients with asthma. And I thought, oh boy, this is going to be rough. You know, aminophylline is one of those drugs that has a very narrow therapeutic window. The dose at which it's efficacious is not too much lower than the dose that causes significant adverse effects. And even in the severely ill patient, I'm not sure that there's remaining indications for using IV aminophylline. I haven't done so in my practice. Our intensivists don't do so.
So in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, we used to bump and bolus,
right,
and we would titrate up to the point where you vomited, and then we knew it was therapeutic.
Right.
Dr. Baker, how old is too old for croup? And should I worry about older patients greater than six with croup symptoms more than the toddlers?
I'm too old to have croup, almost. Croup is typically in younger age range kids. If you look at the, all patients who have croup, the vast majority are going to be in the younger age range child, preschoolers and early schoolers. Now, having said that, I have seen kids 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age, one here, one there, that come in with honest-to-God croup. And I don't know if anecdotally, I don't know that the literature would support this, but anecdotally, those are kids who have had croup many times in the past, probably have some narrowed airway of some sort. Maybe they were intubated as an infant, I don't know, or have some other structural issue that makes them a little bit more vulnerable to turbulent airflow when you add some edema to the sides of the wall. I'm sure that, adults get some inflammation of their upper airways via viral exposures, but maybe are big enough that it's not noisy and the airway compromise isn't as great as usual, as would be for smaller kids. Rich, your experience?
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
Yeah.
Dr. Scarfone, there's some questions about some which inhaled corticosteroid do you choose to start patients on when you're discharging them, and do you wait for them to finish their oral steroids before starting their inhaled corticosteroid?
I'll tackle the second one first. I personally don't wait. I think it's more confusing for families to phase in and phase out medications. What I tell them about albuterol is use it for 3 to 5 days, but then I'm also telling them by the third day, if the child's better, try to start spacing it out every 6 hours. Maybe by the fourth day, it's every 8 hours. So in other words, I'm giving them guidance about tapering the albuterol. Simultaneously, I'm telling them to give prednisone every twice a day for 4 or 5 days, or again, as we talked about, Decadron, and then to then throw an added complication on top of that to go ahead and start this new medicine on day 5. I think it's easier to just send them home with it and start it right from the get-go, right as they're initiating their acute asthma plan. There's not good data to show one is superior to another. The common ones that are used in our community are budesonide and fluticasone. I think budesonide is a little more topically active than fluticasone, but either is reasonable.
And what's the lowest age you feel comfortable using MDI with spacer mask for your patients?
Yeah, I mean, we use it in infants. We've used it in the bronchiolitic patients. We certainly have the small spacer, the smallest masks, so that we can successfully do that. I think that's a population that as soon as you put the mask on their face, they begin crying. They're taking nice deep breaths, and there's really no contraindication to using it in those young babies.
Dr. Baker, when you have patients who present with oropharyngeal puncture wounds, do you recommend prophylactic antibiotics to prevent abscess formation or infection?
That's an awfully good question. I don't know that there's one right answer to that. You're talking about puncture wounds to the posterior pharynx typically. If you puncture the tongue, I'm not sure anybody worries about that. If you puncture the side of the mouth, I'm not sure anybody worries about that so much either, unless it's through and through, and then we still don't worry about that. The back of the throat, though, if you puncture the posterior pharynx, you can jeopardize some vascular structures. You can certainly have a deep enough puncture wound to deposit bacteria back there. I don't know that there have been studies, at least not that I'm aware of, that have looked in a scientific manner looking at prophylactic versus not prophylactic antibiotic treatment for fresh puncture wounds, the posterior pharynx. I would certainly worry about those more than the other locations, and I might investigate those further with some imaging to see if there's any track of any sort or foreign body deposited back there. I have to say that I'm just trying to recollect my own, the kids that I've seen personally with those types of injuries, And my guess is, and again, this is just recollection, which is faulty, but my guess is that we are probably giving some of those kids some prophylactic antibiotics, but not with good scientific evidence that it's effective.
So there are a variety of different questions on some other therapies for bronchiolitis, including, and I think we can agree that there's probably more data that needs to be to come out looking at hypertonic saline, but there's one question about heated high flow and what its role is in the treatment of bronchiolitis.
Sure. So high flow oxygen via nasal cannula is certainly a nice option for the patient who's being hospitalized, and we turn to that quite a lot. In our particular hospital, again, this is going to vary from hospital to hospital, it doesn't mandate that the child is admitted to an intensive care setting. It really depends on the amount of flow support that they require. And I forget exactly the cutoffs, but I think it's 3 liters is the cutoff at our institution. But again, it is a nice option, obviously, for the patient who's being hospitalized.
A few other questions about bronchiolitis have come up, especially around chest x-rays. And there's a couple comments about, are you comfortable that there, how do you rule out bacterial pneumonia in patients with bronchiolitis without a chest x-ray?
Sure. You know, again, looking at the literature, right, so the study out of Toronto suggested that the yield is low. Only 2 patients out of 265 had a true bacterial pneumonia. So going in, you know that. Personal experience, so when I was a younger me, I used to obtain many more x-rays. And, you know, 100 normal chest x-rays later, I decided, maybe I don't need to get this many x-rays. And, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's a small amount of radiation, right, as we know. A chest radiograph is about 2 days' worth of radiation. We're all exposed to radiation walking around Earth, and that's about 2 days' worth of radiation. So it's not the worst thing in the world, but it can lead to overdiagnosis and overtreatment, as we talked about. It really depends on your management style. Are you a test minimizer? Are you a risk minimizer? But suffice to say, the vast majority of these babies do not have bacterial pneumonia. The other argument you'll hear in favor of getting an x-ray is you may uncover an unsuspected diagnosis. And, you know, that's a legitimate concern in a baby with respiratory distress. Perhaps that baby has a mediastinal mass or has undiagnosed CF or some terrible thing. But these are incredibly rare. I don't think we should spend our day looking for zebras, and I certainly don't do so. And again, the yield is going to be fairly low in that setting.
Dr. Baker, what is supportive care for uveitis? Is there a concern for airway obstruction in these patients and the role for dexamethasone?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the role for dexamethasone with uveitis. Again, you know, oftentimes you're dealing with an infected uvula, bacterially infected uvula, and in that context, I think probably steroids wouldn't be the best addition. So if I was going to err on the side of giving some chemical therapy, I'd give an antibiotic, and typically will, unless there's a thermal injury history or some other type of trauma that you can actually pinpoint in the history fairly, you know, fairly accurately. And you know, are there kids with uveitis who eventually get upper airway obstruction that is, you know, life-threatening? I think it would be unusual because the uvula moves around pretty well. But it can, it's a very distensible structure. It can swell very easily, very large. You saw the child that I showed a picture of. He could actually flip that out on the surface of his tongue if he positioned himself in the right way. It's almost like the Budweiser frog commercial. So supportive care, though, is soothing agents, you know, cool liquids, this kind of thing, and maybe some anti-inflammatories, I don't know.
And I think we have time. Let's do one last question, and this is, can you comment on prolonged albuterol or terbutaline and cardiac ischemia risk?
Yeah, again, I don't know that there's a lot of data on that. The data that I'm familiar with, probably the most familiar with, is with the use of IV tributyline. Not necessarily long-term. I don't know that those studies, how long they followed patients, but looking at the rates of cardiovascular side effects like dysrhythmias, hypertension, they did follow troponins in those patients. A very small percentage of those patients, on the order of about 3% or less, did have some changes that might have suggested mild ischemia, but was not thought to be clinically significant, and in that very severely ill patient probably doesn't rise to the level of being a contraindication to using those drugs.
All right, I think we are at lunchtime.